Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Chris Weber from Cascade, Idaho, on the show for the first time. Chris is a fishing guide year-round on the famed Lake Cascade. We're talking about the giant perch out there. Now, Lake Cascade, more recently, gets a lot of headlines in the wintertime, but what happens the rest of the year? It's really fun in this conversation to talk about the spring perch fishing and just how exciting it can really be. In fact, if you really are looking for a brand new adventure, I would really, really consider giving Chris a call and making your way out there. It is a destination for just pure adventure. It can be a family trip. It's a beautiful place in the world when you get up in and around Lake Cascade, and there's a lot of great things to do there for the whole family, including the fishing, and that's what we talk about in this interview with Chris Weber. Let's get to it. TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. If you're going to be doing any boat rigging whatsoever this season, check out a complete listing of products at TKICNC.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. If you have any fishing memory or a fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work here at the JMO headquarters. We are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at RizaviTaxidermyStudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. Zooloft Construction from Fargo, North Dakota is your trusted partner when it comes to protecting and enhancing your property, servicing the surrounding area with over 40 years of combined experience. They've built a reputation for delivering exceptional roofing, siding, gutter, and window solutions. With a team of skilled professionals using quality brands and products, that's how they ensure lasting results. To sum it up, Zooloft Construction is committed to exceeding customer expectations. If you want an appointment for a free estimate, check out Zooloft Construction at their website, zooloftconstruction.com, or call them at 701-630-0197. All those contacts are in the description of this podcast. Shields is a one-stop shop retailer with all your outdoor needs covered. Shields has all the top brands on inventory in every department and a knowledgeable staff known for great service. With over 30 locations across the country, you can find the nearest store by going online to shields.com. If you can't get to a store, rest assured all their best deals are online as well. So once again, head to shields.com for more detailed information. That link is in the description of this podcast. Let's get to know you a little bit, man. What's your story with fishing?
I grew up fishing in Wisconsin. I was kind of a diehard fisherman in high school and in college. I started working for Shields All Sports in college, and that kind of sparked the whole getting to know the industry more and getting to know products more and stuff like that. And while I was in college, I was studying criminal justice and Spanish, but I was always fishing on the side. It's kind of like basically a hobby, you know, like how everything starts. And then I graduated from UW Oshkosh. Became a cop, got hired with the Columbia County Sheriff's Office, worked as a deputy sheriff for 9 years doing that. And then I just kind of always kept fishing on the weekends and during the week with my wife, had a lot of friends that did it. And so when law enforcement was going good, but I knew that I didn't want to do that for 20 years, I kind of decided to explore other avenues with, like, you know, I guess we call it a side hustle when you're a cop, and it's just another way to make money, another side business. So I started that, doing that for about 4 or 5 years at Columbia County Sheriff's Office, and kind of decided to make that as a career. I did it when I was a cop and being a guide kind of part-time, doing it on the weekends or in the mornings when you're going in before work. You kind of make it into it's just another way to make money, but you're only guiding maybe 30 or 40 days a year, with that. So But a cool thing that kind of happened with me and my family, my wife, we started vacationing out west in Idaho, actually, and started fishing on Lake Cascade, the famous giant perch fishery that a lot of people from the Midwest know about. And so we vacationed out here twice, befriended some people, and that was pretty much all it took to realize that I wanted to move out here. And the stars kind of aligned, the doors kind of opened, and I got an opportunity to get a guide license to guide on Lake Cascade. Obviously, that'd be full time, and I would have to switch my career path. So after about 10 years of law enforcement, I hung it up and decided to make the move. And me and my wife have lived here for about 5 or 6 years now. Just wrapped up our fourth ice fishing season on Cascade, and then we guide full time year round. So we're just starting here. Our open water season is going to start here probably this week. And we'll be doing that here throughout the summer.
You know, growing up in Wisconsin, what part of Wisconsin did you grow up in? Like, where were you fishing? What were some of your home bodies of water?
Yeah, it was like South Central Wisconsin. So we grew up, I grew up in Jefferson. So we were fishing the Rock River, which is kind of getting a little bit more popular for walleye. So you're doing a lot of vertical walleye jigging in the springtime there for the run, and then trolling in the summertime. A lot of catfishing on the Rock River. And then as it got into like, when I went to UW Oshkosh in college, we were fishing Lake Winnebago and the whole Winnebago system there, like Lake Poygan and Butamore. And then when I was a deputy sheriff down in Columbia County, that's like by kind of in between Wisconsin Dells and Madison there. So you're fishing like the Wisconsin River chain, Lake Wisconsin, you know, has phenomenal walleye run obviously in the spring, but then you also have a really good population of smallmouth bass and crappies, perch, occasional muskie. So when I started guiding, I started guiding on Lake Wisconsin and the Wisconsin River. And then I'd also guide up on Big Green for smallmouth for some of my clients. I was guiding up on Lake Peatonwell for walleyes in the wintertime. I did some ice fishing trips there. But it's kind of cool in Wisconsin. Like when you get a guide license in Wisconsin, you can obviously guide everywhere, you know, every lake and doing whatever you want, ice fishing, open water, whatever. Whereas in Idaho, the weird thing is that if you get a guide license, it's really restricted on what you can do. It's only, you have to have each individual body of water that you want to guide on, you have to have a license for that body of water, and then also the means and what you're doing with it. So if you're ice fishing on Lake Cascade, you know, just because you have a guide permit to guide on Lake Cascade doesn't mean you can even do open water. There's a certain outfitter that only has ice fishing, you know, and then so they can only you know, work essentially for 2 to 3 months out of the year, and then open water fishing, they don't have a license for that. I have a guide license that allows me to do both ice fishing and open water fishing, which is obviously, you know, beneficial that I can work year round. But yeah, in Wisconsin, that was kind of a cool thing where you can, if you figure out a bite and you can actually put a trip together and advertise, and you have people that actually want to pay you to take you out on that, you know, where you can actually guide them and make money doing it. Yeah, you can do any body of water in Wisconsin, but there's also some cons to that as well. So,
and I definitely want to, I'm excited to get into the Idaho stuff, but I'm still thinking about like early in your career. What were some of your specialties? Where was your confidence at in terms of maybe your fishing style? Or
so I started, like I said, when I was in law enforcement, obviously it's a stressful job, right? So yeah, I was kind of using fishing as like a coping mechanism, I guess you could kind of call it that, where I would be fishing, you know, probably 4 to 7 times a week, especially in the springtime when the fishing's obviously really good. You're fishing walleyes a lot, trolling and vertical jigging, you know, with various rigs. Like it kind of starts out, and as soon as ice out starts on Lake Wisconsin, you're using like Dubuque rigs and pulling various different, you know, paddle tail jigs and stuff like that upstream. As soon as that walleye run kind of ends, then you're transitioning into, you know, your panfish, your crappies and stuff like that. So just the mere fact that I was fishing so much, you know, day in and day out, I was just slowly figuring out the lake. And I probably fished Lake Wisconsin, like I said, I was a cop for 10 years. I probably fished Lake Wisconsin, obviously, for the first 5 years before I turned it into a career or a side hustle or a business. you know, that's just kind of cool. It's just, as you're a law enforcement and you're wanting to, you know, take your brain off of the job, more or less, a lot of cops do start like a business at like about 4 or 5 years in, you know, like a side hustle. Some people do woodworking. Some people do, you know, lawn care and just various things to get your mind off of the job. And, you know, fishing was always just that one thing that I just did, had a lot of confidence in it, especially in the springtime. And, but like starting a business or starting a fishing business when you have a full-time job is very difficult. And a lot of people, you know, maybe you'll do it for a couple of years and then do something else. The hardest thing for me starting out was just obviously finding clients that had like confidence in that they would pay me money to take them to catch fish, you know? And I think that just slowly starts with, you're obviously not doing, you know, 300 trips a year, your first year. You know, just kind of slowly builds and builds and builds. You know, I had to do things like discounts for people to take out. Like when I started my business, obviously you put a post on Facebook, so I say, I'm a fishing guide now. People kind of turn their heads like, oh, who's this guy? You know, just a new guy that nobody has really heard about. And, but yeah, try to be creative and just keep at it. And, I was doing a lot of like discounts where I would do like, $100 for other cops and nurses and doctors and stuff, where if you wanted to go fish with me, it's just $100. And then, you know, the word spreads. They maybe somebody will take the chance, you take them out to catch fish, and then it's just word of mouth spreads. And so, yeah, it just kind of morphs into something. You just do more and more trips every year, make it into try to finding, you know, better bites, better quality trips. And hopefully you don't get skunked when you take them out fishing. A cool thing for me is I had a partnership with Shields when I was working there in college. I had obviously made good friends that I kept in contact with. And then so when 5 years later, after I was a law enforcement, I was trying to start a fishing business, I went back to Appleton Shields and I spoke to the manager, who I was, you know, acquainted with still, and I explained to him what I was doing. And luckily for me, they took a chance and like gave me a pro staff. So they helped me out with a lot of gear and stuff and good rods, good quality equipment. And then obviously promoting my name and publicity and stuff like that on social media. That definitely helped me get kind of established. But at the end of the day, you have to, you know, be like have confidence in what you're selling is like good enough for what people are paying. So it was, for me, it was always like when I was going out fishing, I was using it as an excuse that I was going scouting rather than just, you know, me by myself in the boat fishing. So it's just another cool avenue that you kind of took my mind off of law enforcement a little bit more. And then obviously it gave me a drive to, you know, make money and make it into like a reputable business and having a reputable name in the fishing industry, which is tough because there's a lot of guides in Wisconsin.
It sounds like, you know, you're probably very self-taught, like just understanding that time on the water is invaluable and attacking that way. But I'm curious, like if you had, you know, any, you know, other particular influences, you know, when you're growing up, you know, mentorship or maybe just content consumption or just maybe just some of those things that sort of mentored or influenced you when you were in those stages of your career where a lot of learning was happening and you were advancing and just getting better at the fishing aspect.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up like catfishing, you know, and like just worm fishing or sink bait on the bottom in the river. And then you're just hanging out all night. That river fishing was pretty fun for me. And then you always have the classic white bass bite on the Rock River. So that's always fun. But yeah, as far as mentors go, I mean, there's obviously a long list of people that I've fished with that I've picked up things, you know, from that. My father-in-law, for instance, I got super lucky and married into an awesome family. And my father-in-law, they had a cabin on Lake Wisconsin. So the reason that we moved, or that I actually wanted a job in Columbia County, like for law enforcement, was I was dating my now wife in college, and she had a cabin on Lake Wisconsin. So her childhood, like every weekend, they'd go up there and spend the summers on Lake Wisconsin, you know, sandbarring and like walleye fishing. And so when I started dating her, the first time I met the parents, I believe, we went to her childhood cabin and met her family for Easter. And so the very first time I went fishing there, they had this little 3 foot wide John boat. And it was like maybe a 14 footer with like a 3 horse, motor on the back. And the name of the boat was called Suck My Wake. and so my wife, or my girlfriend at the time, now wife, we get there from college and we're just going to be there for the weekend and meet her family and whatnot. And she pulls out the 3 horse motor and we pull the boat down to the water and we go out fishing. And within the first 15 minutes, I hook into the biggest walleye of my life. I got a 30 and a half inch walleye.
Oh yeah.
And I'm using her dad's ugly stick with like a rusty blue jig and a yellow little mini twister tail, no stinger hook. And I hook on a fathead, you know, and I pitch it out there and I'm jigging it. And I think it was probably like my second or third cast. And my wife, I don't think at the time had gone fishing with me maybe 4 or 5 times. She didn't really know, you know, that I was a decent fisherman, or at least maybe she, I don't know, but I hook into this thing and it thumps it, you know, and so I'm reeling in. She thinks I have a snag cause there's heavy current and it's not moving. It's just kind of staying down. And so we flopped this thing into the boat. Of course, we didn't have a net or anything. I just had to get her to pull and grab onto the thing, you know, and I hurled her over the side of this little John boat and I'm awestruck. And we yell, we're making noise. And as I'm looking down, the fish flops up and it hits the very top side of the boat. And luckily for me, it fell back into the boat and not over the water, because I still, you know, we measured it. And to this day, it's still my biggest walleye I've ever caught. And so, I mean, that just kind of sparked the, you know, just another memory in the bank that kind of sparked the whole fishing drive. But the funny thing was, is when her dad showed up, instead of meeting me, you know, and shaking my hand, like, you know, as like his daughter's boyfriend, he like walks right past me and he's like, let me see this fish, you know, because of course we were going to mount it. So, but yeah, it's just good. So I've had a lot of mentors over the years for sure. You know, and a lot of the partnership with Shields and stuff kind of tags, or it pairs you up with people that are really driven in the fishing industry. So a lot of my friends from Shields, you know, even from college and just buddies back home that I fished, you know, there'll be a lot of law enforcement buddies that obviously like fishing, as well. And they, you know, so it's just like anything else. You just kind of hang out with the people that like doing the things you do. And, it of course makes you more driven.
Yeah. And it, and you definitely sound like you have that learner mentality. Like you, every single time you go out, you know, you're trying to put a piece of the puzzle together. You've obviously made it your own deal, like as you go, but you can't do that without that learner's mentality. Would you describe yourself that way?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, more than anything, I think if you're out fishing and you're not catching much and there's a guy next to you that's just hammering them, you know, there's a couple times in my life where you're just sitting next to a guy, or maybe you're watching the guy in the boat next to you and they're just hammering them. And, you know, some people would be like, oh, that guy was pretty lucky today. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what in the hell is that guy using? You know, what is he, how is he working whatever is on the tip of his line? Like, is it a bait thing? Is it a depth thing? Is there a structure there? Is there, you know, and you're the wheels start turning, trying to figure it out. And it kind of, you lose sleep at night thinking about, hey man, I want to be able to catch as many fish as that guy did in that certain context. Eventually, you know, over time, you just kind of figure it out. And there's definitely little variables that you figure out that catches more fish. And, you know, over the lifetime, it just, you know, compounds. And it's definitely an obsession or addiction at the end of the day, where, you know, you just want to feel that thump on the end of your pole. And you just want to be able to figure it out, like put the pieces together and figure it out. And then, you know, not just to like be able to post a picture of a pile of fish or whatever, but just like for peace of mind, knowing that you have confidence where you can go out and do it again tomorrow, and knowing that you have, you know, have that. There's definitely an obsession there, an addiction. I'm trying to figure it out, trying to figure out the variables and just put the pieces together.
TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. If you're going to be doing any boat rigging whatsoever this season, check out a complete listing of products at tkicnc.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. If you have any fishing memory or fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work here at the JMO headquarters. We are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at RizaviTaxidermyStudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. Shields is a one-stop shop retailer with all your outdoor needs covered. Shields has all the top brands on inventory in every department and a knowledgeable staff known for great service. With over 30 locations across the country, you can find the nearest store by going online to Shields.com. If you can't get to a store, rest assured all their best deals are online as well. So once again, head to Shields.com for more detailed information. That link is in the description of this podcast. Zooloft Construction from Fargo, North Dakota is your trusted partner when it comes to protecting and enhancing your property, servicing the surrounding area with over 40 years of combined experience. They've built a reputation for delivering exceptional roofing, siding, gutter, and window solutions. With a team of skilled professionals using quality brands and products, that's how they ensure lasting results. To sum it up, Zooloft Construction is committed to exceeding customer expectations. If you want an appointment for a free estimate, check out Zooloft Construction at their website, zooloftconstruction.com, or call them at 701-630-0197. All those contacts are in the description of this podcast. Let's get out to where you're at now. You talked about your journey and moving out west. That's a huge move. That not just a career move, but a landscape, you know, a geographical move. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. How long have you been out there?
Yeah, so I moved out here when I was 30, in my 30s. So that would have been the spring of 21, like early spring of 21. So now it's, you know, 2025, we just wrapped up, I believe, our fourth ice fishing season. Yeah, we're on our fifth open water season now. So it was definitely a big movement. I was obviously a life change for sure, which is cool how you can just do that, you know, if you want to. But you wouldn't be able to do that unless you have, you know, for us, we don't have any kids, so that definitely helped. We didn't have any, like, attachment there for schools or anything. And so me and my wife, we've started traveling out west, you know, a few years before that, like elk hunting. We went to Colorado and Idaho elk hunting, before that, but it was, we knew that, moving out west would be pretty cool, but we didn't really know what we would be doing. Right. So she's, my wife is a nurse, so it's pretty helpful with her where she can just go and find a new job, because nurses always need, you know, they always need nurses, for instance. And so she became a travel nurse. And then for me, I had the job lined up with being a guide guiding on Lake Cascade. So we kind of found Cascade about 2 years before we moved here. Actually, no, I take that back. So we came out here in Idaho for an elk hunt in September. While we were on that elk hunt, we sucked elk hunting. We didn't even see any elk, but then we were driving past Lake Cascade. And so I ended up swinging into local bait shop, Tackle Tom's. And I started talking with the guys behind the desk. And I'm like, hey, you guys, you know, catch like big perch in Cascade? Because I had always heard about it on like podcasts. And at that time, I don't think I watched any YouTube videos on it or anything, but just people talking about it. And anyway, the guy behind the desk, he's like, yeah, I caught these this morning. He pulls out his phone and he has like a picture of 30, like absolute jumbo perch. I'm like, huh? It's like, so they're biting pretty good, huh? And he's like, yeah, they're biting really good. I was like, would you guys like take us out fishing? And they're like, well, sure. I was like, all right. And then so we went up elk hunting for another 5 days, didn't shoot any elk, came back through. And then that evening we were coming through, I called them. I said, hey, are you guys out fishing? I'm like, yeah. He's like, come on in. So they ended up taking four of us out, me and my wife, and then my brother and then his buddy. So our four people that we were elking with. And in like 2.5 hours, we filled a cooler with like probably 40 to 50 perks that were all like 11 to 15 inches. And not only that, we were the only boat on the lake. And there's no limit on the perch, you know, so just all these things that were like coming from the Midwest. I'm just like in absolute awe, right? There's no boats. There's no limit. These perch are huge. I'm just like surrounded by mountains and it's sun setting over the mountains. And I'm like, you know, it was kind of like a holy, holy shit moment where I'm like, this is unbelievable. And then, so we end up cleaning our fish right in the parking lot there. There's a red wolf or a red fox came up and like was trying to eat the carcasses and stuff. And we're the only ones in the parking lot. Obviously we fill we put the fillets in the cooler and we're driving back and I'm like, man, that'd be cool to live there. And then, so they said, you think that's good? You should come back for ice fishing. So then that winter we planned an ice fishing trip. And so me and my wife, we flew like our Vexlars and our rods and stuff. And then we ended up renting a snowmobile, from Tackle Tom's and then fished for 2 days and then went skiing for 2 days. And the weather was fantastic. We ended up catching a 17 inch perch on that trip, which I didn't realize, but it tied the state catch and release record. And we caught it on a tip up with a worm. And which is obviously a little weird to this day, I don't use any tip ups and I've been guiding it for 4 years, you know. we just brought a couple tip ups, I think, and put out some set lines. But yeah, so it was great. Just hammered them, caught like 35 fish and they were all like over 11 to 15 inches. And, you know, average was 11 to 15. And of course, we caught a few that were over 15 and 117. So I was like, yeah, we gotta think about really moving here. And so I just continued my relationship with the guys at the bait shop. And then ironically enough, at the same time, they were trying to get a guide license for the bait shop. And so they were trying to organize, you know, a guide license through the two outfitters that had ice fishing permits. So one of the people that had the permit was the big ski resort called Tamarack Resort. And they had a license to guide, but they weren't using it. So it was just basically sitting vacant more or less. At the same time, I kept in contact with the guys at the bait shop. I said, if you really want, you know, if you need a guide or if you get the guide license and you have a guide license for me, I'd be happy to move to Idaho with me and my family. And they're like, oh, okay, you know, and we just kind of left at that. About a month later, I called them again and said, hey, any moving on the guide license? They're like, yeah, we're actually, you know, making progress on it. I said, all right, cool. And then, so I kept checking in with them and kind of befriending them. And then what I did is I ended up selling, I convinced them to come to Wisconsin and fish. And I said, you guys should really come to Wisconsin in like April when the fishing's like really good for walleye and white bass and smallmouth and stuff. So I convinced them. They ended up having five guys from Idaho flew out to Wisconsin and I guided them for 3 days. And so me and my father-in-law, actually, because there was four guys and I think it could fit. I could probably put four on my boat, but it would have been really cramped. So I ended up doing two and two. So then we guided them for 3 days. And ironically enough, it was like kind of the stars aligned on Lake Wisconsin. It was like first week in April, the smallmouth bass on Lake Wisconsin in early April, like right about now, maybe a couple weeks ago, they school up in the shallows there, right on the edges of the river, right at the mouth. And so if you find them, they're like schooled up. It's like one after the next. And so you can like pitch blade baits at them and catch, you know, 30, 40 fish days on Lake Wisconsin. So we did that for one day. The next day we went up to Nakusa and fished walleyes, hammered them. And then the day after that, we went and found white bass on Lake Wisconsin, which they've never gone white bass fishing. So that was a new species for them. So we just hammered fish 3 days in a row and made me look really good, right?
Yeah.
And so they, you know, of course, the fishing's like the best of the year, like that weekend, which was good. But they're like, yeah, you know, we really need a guide out here, and we really want, you know, we really think you'd be a good fit. And I'm like, all right, sounds good. Let me know. So then, like a couple weeks after that, they call me like, you want to move to Idaho? We got a guide license for you. And like, I think I had a 5-minute conversation with my wife and I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Oh man.
Yeah. So we just kind of, it took us 3 months. We ended up remodeling our house right after that phone call. And we turned it into an Airbnb because we lived kind of right on Lake Wisconsin there. And turned it into an Airbnb, which is another business that we started. And then, you know, I think the Airbnb was finally completed about 3 days before we moved.
I mean, and part of this, a big part of this story, which is you know, it's super interesting to me, and we've already kind of touched on it, but like those opportunities, you know, the way Idaho, you know, and you can kind of explain it better, but the way Idaho sort of regulates, you know, the outfitters, the fishing outfitters, and ultimately, you know, the guides on those lakes, it's regulated pretty hard. Like it's way easier in the Midwest to do something like that. But that kind of opportunity, I mean, you're kind of like, you know, a great white buffalo, so to speak, that like you have the opportunity to guide year round. Cause that's a totally different than just being seasonal where, you know, other guys just have opportunities to guide, permits to guide in the wintertime, you know, the ice season out there, which definitely probably gets more headlines if, you know, the farther you're removed from it, you know, like those of us here in the Midwest, you know, we nowadays, you know, that whole ice fishing bit out there is, you know, more and more popular. But the year round thing, I mean, that's like, I mean, I'm sure you were aware of it to some extent, but like, that was like a really exclusive opportunity that you turned that into.
Yeah, for sure. There is, I mean, so just like, this is public record, obviously, but there's only two open water permits, and they call them outfitter licenses. So there's two outfitter licenses, and then there's a total of three ice fishing outfitter licenses. And yeah, so to have a outfitter license where you can, you know, guide open water and ice fishing, that's definitely an exclusive. You know, I wouldn't call it a monopoly, but it's getting close. You know, like you have exclusive rights more or less to guide on that. There's pros and cons to it, obviously, you know, for that. And I guess taking a step back, the reason that is back in like, and this is just what I'm told, that back in like the 70s and 80s, maybe even earlier than that, there was some big game outfitters that, you know, obviously had a market, and then there was more and more outfitters, people wanting to guide for big game. And so they went to the legislature and in Idaho, they made it a law that there has to be every new outfitter license has to be approved by the Idaho Guide and Licensing Board. So they created this board. And of that board, you know, the majority rules for the vote. And I believe 3 out of the 5 have to be existing outfitters. One has to be from Fish and Game, and then one has to be a civilian. And so they just created this this system where they're just very limited on the new licenses that they give, you know. So how Tamarack got a new license, and again, this is just what I'm told. I haven't really done a whole lot of research on it, but I believe they got a when they came into fruition, you know, as a new ski resort back in the early 2000s, and they were starting to make their ski runs and stuff, the state of Idaho gave them a bunch of permits to outfit or to for activities for their thing, you know, clients to do. You know, in Idaho, if you're making money off of the land or the water, you have to have a license to do that as a licensed guide. And if you don't do that, their penalties are very harsh, like jail time, you know, like misdemeanors and arrests. One of the licenses they gave, you know, was fishing, for ice fishing and open water fishing. And because it changed hands so many times with Tamarack as a ski resort, you know, they're a booming ski resort now. It's absolutely amazing what they've done up there. But in the early days, they were, you know, in financial trouble, especially around 2008, the housing crisis and stuff. I believe they went bankrupt maybe once or twice. Anyway, now they're doing great, but around the time where I was getting involved was the time that they were starting to look at getting, you know, their fishing program up and running and actually using their guide license. And so just ironically, as the way the chips fall, I was the guy that kind of stepped in and started it. And, you know, now it's just a beautiful relationship that we have. I'm an employee under that ski resort, but they're very hands-off and they let me do a lot of things with like running my own business and like in advertising and making media and recruiting, you know, clients and reaching out to different connections, you know. They're very non-restrictive on that. So it's just a win-win. You know, they focus on everything a ski resort does, and I focus on, you know, promoting the fishing business as much as possible, and which obviously helps them, and it also helps me.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I think that's definitely like part of the story, you know, cause again, we're not there, right? Like most people listening to this aren't from Idaho and would just not necessarily understand or realize that, where, gosh, you go to, you know, like any reasonable, certainly the major or capital fisheries in the Midwest, and it's, and, you know, a huge percentage of the boats you would see on the water are guides, right? Like working guides.
Oh, for sure.
But you go, you know, our experiences where we've gone out and filmed on Cascade. Yeah. I guess when we were out there, we were just enjoying it so much. I didn't really ask the question very seriously to anybody, but you know, you're always thinking like, this is seriously so epic and amazing. And you know, just with like everything you described, the location, the views, it's such a life experience to just visit there, much less, you know, like you say, you know, go to Tamarack and ski on the mountain or the snowmobilers. But you know, the fishing, I mean, it's such an amazing adventure. And when you put it all together, it's like, how come, I guess this is when we were out there and we were ice fishing every time I've been out there, but it's like, how come, like if this lake was anywhere in the Midwest, it would be like, it would be wall to wall. Like there would, like, it'd be so much more popular. Like where are all the people? And then, and underneath that, it's like, how come none of these locals are guiding? Like, how come that's not a super popular thing, you know? But that explains it, is that it is kind of regulated. And like you say, there's sort of that council, there's sort of the gatekeepers, so to speak, are outfitters themselves. So they're probably not super motivated to just sign every single application that comes through, right? Like there's probably a little bit of that, not to get in the weeds there, but
there's a lot of litigation. There's a lot of litigation and, you know, bureaucracy that comes with it. If they were going to like petition to get a new license, for instance, you'd have to like petition the board, and then you'd have to prove that there would be so much want for, you know, new people wanting to do guided fishing, but the existing outfitters aren't doing enough, that there's enough to justify a new and additional fishing license, or like a outfitter license. And then that has to like open up, then they go to vote. Then it would have to be signed by the governor. And this can take like 4 to 6 years, or I mean, it could take a long time just for a new permit to be approved. And then not only that, the permit, once a new one or two is approved, it doesn't go to like necessarily to the guy that petitioned the board to open it back up, you know, so it wouldn't necessarily, or I don't believe it has to go to that person. So there's really no guarantee or reason for somebody to do that. You know, it's definitely at their discretion, you know, and the guide and licensing board, of course, does, you know, I would think that they do their due diligence to make sure that there is enough, guides on the water. You know, like we've done I think we've done a good job promoting and getting business. You know, we're fully booked in the wintertime. We're 7 days a week for probably 85 days straight, you know, 7 days a week. We're taking out 6 to probably 12 guys. You know, so our calendar does fill up for ice fishing in particular, and it's super popular, but I don't think there's a whole lot of people that, you know, still want a guided fishing trip that don't get it between my, you know, ourselves and the other two outfitters.
Sure.
That are there. I think it's probably enough people out there, but I mean, one of the pros of that is that, you know, hopefully if you do buy a guided trip in Idaho, that you do go with a person it's their full-time job, you know, they're pretty reputable. Mm-hmm. They're out there every day. They're not like, you know, in Wisconsin, they're not like a full-time cop and and a guy on the weekends type of person, you know. So, but with that being said, you do pay a little bit more too, because now you have an outfitter license that has to collect some money. You have a fishing guide that more than likely is, you know, working his own business, has his own gear, but he still has to make money, you know. So there's a little bit, there's a few more hands in the pot, in that regard, where the trips do cost a little bit more, I think. You know, you might have some more expensive trips for some specialty type of fishing operations in, say, Wisconsin or some like destination areas. But overall, I think you do get a better quality trip just with the, you know, expertise of the guide, and hopefully that, you know, guide, because he's doing it full time and making it a career, it's, you know, a better quality product that you're getting, and better trip that you're getting.
No, I like sort of including that part of the conversation. I think it's educational. It kind of sort of explains the framework of you know, just sort of you and then and that the industry there on Cascade is, you know, it's definitely interesting, and I think it's awesome. Now, I want to hear more about the open water, because that's kind of what we're on the cusp on, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of want to dig into that a little bit, as far as, you know, how the open water season comes out, the fish patterns, and just what the fishing is like, and just some of those cool elements. So how do we get into that?
Yeah, so the open water fishing, I mean, as we speak right now, the lake, this is like the first, well, it's probably going on the 3rd week in April now. The lake is probably about half open with ice, and one of the cool things on Lake Cascade that happens is, because you have all these tributaries, all these creeks coming down with warmer water than what's in the lake, and then you also have a whole lot of hot springs on the lake as well. It heats the water from below, so that ice, because it's so thick, it hangs around for a long time. But that water temp is still, you know, as of now, the water temp's like in the low 40s already, and so.
And the lake's like half frozen still.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
So
insane.
you'll still have ice on top that's just kind of more or less like a foot and a half of slush, just kind of lingers. But then, yeah, you're gonna have temps in the mid 40s, you know. So yeah, we're having the perch are spawning as we're speaking. So a lot of times when that ice comes off, that next day when we put the boat on, you know, we're catching post spawn fish. You know, because water temp will be like 46, 47, and the ice just came off the day before.
That's
Yeah, so
fascinating.
she heats up quick from those hot springs and the tributaries and stuff. And so yeah, you're catching post spawn fish. So a lot of the times when you're going out there, you're not catching, you know, these fish that are all ballooned up and look good like when they do in the ice fishing. You know, like a lot of other fisheries, like, you know, Mississippi River or whatever, you can obviously get some pre-spawn fish. Lake Winnebago, you can get pre-spawn perch. But here in Cascade, there a lot of them are post-spawn, which is interesting. But the cool thing is that the fishing in the spring and in the fall for open water fishing in Cascade is second to none. It is absolutely phenomenal if you're in them. You know, the perch school up and they're in the shallows, and when you find them and they're school up like that, it's lights out. I mean, it can be every cast for as long as you want to fish them. And then the size is also good too. You know, like we were talking before, the average size on Cascade right now for those adult class are like 11 to 15 inches. You know, there's definitely a big population of younger fish coming up, like a big boom of younger fish, like 6 to 9 inches. But yeah, there's still a huge population of those bigger fish that when they school up and you're casting either paddle tail jigs or blade baits at them or however you want to catch them, they're, you know, they smack it. They're super aggressive, and it's just one after the next. So
I mean, is there like a big migration, like as far as like a big spawn run? I mean, you know, you talk about them schooling up. If you're going to break the lake down a little bit, generally speaking, as far as, you know, the pattern, sort of where are some of these fish located, and it is a reservoir.
Yeah, so they
So,
made
yeah.
long story short on the whole reservoir. Yeah, they made the dam in like the 50s, and they just created the dammed up the Payette River, created this reservoir, and it wasn't really good perch fish until like the early 2000s. Like 2008 was like kind of the biblical hatch that started it. So, but yeah, as far as the fishing goes, and where they're spawning, so they're going to be. There's definitely a population that go up into the rivers to spawn, like the main North Fork of the Payette, north of the lake. They spawn up there, and then they also spawn a lot on the shorelines, on the west shorelines there, but they also spawn on the east side. So basically they spawn all over in the shallows, you know? So you can definitely find them schooled up in the shallows in like 5 to 10 feet of water, either, you know, staging up as they're spawning or, you know, post spawn. They like to feed, you know, obviously together as like a big pack. So when you're using your electronics and you find them, it's kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, there they are. Yeah. So one of the cool things, that they, as far as the reservoir goes, is that because it is a reservoir, it goes up and down, you know, maybe 10 to 13 feet a year. So in the springtime, when the water's really low, there's no weeds, there barely any weeds, you know, so the fish are all exposed on the electronics. And then when they school up, they're just there. As the weeds progress, like into June and July, they get harder and harder to find, obviously. They go into the weeds and they also go spread out deep, so they're not schooled up feeding. But then as the end of August hits, that water level goes back down again, and so at the end of in June it'll be 10 feet higher, and then the end of September it'll be 10 feet lower, usually. Yeah. And what that does is it creates the weed growth, but then it also lowers the below the weed line. So it just, as in September and August, as that water is dropping and those weeds get shallower and shallower, it pushes all those fish out into the open again, and so that's when you're targeting and they school up again. So they school up in the spring and they school up in the fall. And that's when you could just really hammer them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's interesting for us to talk about, because, you know, for anybody that has experience out there or anybody that's consuming that content, I kind of always go back to this, that wintertime deal is kind of, you know, what we get to see as a spectacle from far away. But, you know, experiencing it myself, when we've been out there, you know, that ice fishing, you know, nobody just drills one hole and catches all the big fish that they want in the wintertime. You know, being able to break down spots and then move, you know, kind of, you know, just because those individual big fish, you know, they aren't all in one place. But in the spring, you know, that's the opportunity when, you know, from the sounds of it, and it just makes total sense. That if you wanted to experience another level of Lake Cascade, I feel like this is what I got to go out and do next. And just, you know, preparing for this podcast, it's like, we have to talk about this open water deal, because of that point you just made, is like all these big perch, not all of them, you know, they're not all in one spot, but if you were ever going to get a school of them, it's not in the wintertime. If you're ever going to get a school of 50 or 100 or, you know, however big those schools can get, where you have the populations of those bigger class fish in one place, where on one drift, and it's multiple people in the boat, and it's cast after cast, and you can probably select baits. Maybe we can get into that, but like, you know, what your approach is to catching the nicer fish, you know, cast after cast, like that's when it's going to happen. I think that is what's fun to point out. And then just to circle back to, I think it's fascinating talking about that warm water. That is such a cool, like a foreign thing. I think that probably doesn't happen everywhere. It might happen more often than we understand. But the thought of like the day that ice out is, you can potentially put your boat in and find mid 40 degree water the day after ice out, because there you've got warm water coming out of the mountain, you've got, you know, warm water coming in as runoff. Super fascinating.
There was a day, just as we were wrapping up our ice fishing season in like the third week in March, I was doing some scouting and I went into a bay that has a bunch of hot springs, and the water temp was 39 degrees as I was ice fishing. You know, so the perch are starting to milk at that time, you know. Yeah. So yeah, getting back to the schools of fish and how big they can get, you know, there's one school that I found in the fall, that the school of perch had to be 500 yards long by 100 yards wide, and in really shallow water and a sand flat. And you know, if you're casting into that school, you're obviously guaranteed to get one, or at least get hit, I should say. And you know, and then the smallest one you catch is like 10 inches, you know, so it can get absolutely silly. Yeah. On Cascade, it can get western real quick, but It doesn't always happen, you know. Obviously, there's slower days in the spring, and there's slower days in the fall. Maybe that school dissipated, or somebody came in with a boat and just kind of stirred it up and spread them all out. But yeah, if you do it right, it's cast after cast. You know, I've had a guided trip where we easily caught over 250 fish, and the smallest one was 10 inches. You know, with four guys casting, you know, as much as you can cast. If you're, you know, how many times you can cast in 4 hours, that's about how many fish you're going to catch is the best days, you know,
Yeah.
that you can have. Average day, I would say, in the springtime, if you leave with like 30 perch, you know, that's a win. So we usually have a boat limit of 30 perch, you know, because we don't want to obviously exploit the resource. And so if you can catch your 30 fish and get out of there, and then also catch and release after that, catch a bass or a couple trout in the meantime, that's a fantastic, you know, trip that you can expect to have in May and June for sure.
And I don't even want to breeze over, you know, the other species that are out there. Like, you know, you mentioning the trout and stuff. I mean,
Oh yeah.
clearly there's big trout in that lake. I mean, that is
Oh yeah.
just the incidental catches that you have out there on that
Yeah, to
reservoir is insane.
accidentally, if you accidentally catch a 25-inch trout, nobody's really upset about
Yeah, that's the
that.
stuff that happens. Yeah, I love that. But talking about your approach, I kind of want to, you know, sort of set that expectation of what your sort of strategy and approach is. And I think, you know, I would love the idea of somebody getting inspired and maybe pulling their boat over there. But the reality is I want to talk as much about you and kind of how you operate as much as possible, because probably the best opportunity for somebody to go and experience this is probably to go out and get in your boat. You know, I mean, that's just the
Yeah.
reality. Like, no, like, you know, kudos to anybody that's down to pull their boat up into the mountains of Idaho, you know, to experience this. I would certainly be tempted to that, but really, I want to talk about, you know, specifically what you like to do, to get people excited about probably just giving you a call. I think that's not unreasonable to say. But yeah, like what you see as being sort of the best approach this time of year when you are trying to, you know, how you spend your time on the electronics, what you're kind of looking for, and then the presentations. I want to kind of get into that nitty gritty and, you know, of so your thought process, your strategy, your decision making, just to kind of paint that picture.
Yeah, for sure. So we have our operation, myself and another guide, Parker Weller, that works with me every day. He's been guiding with me since the beginning. And we have two boats. So I've got a 21-foot Lund, and then I've got a 24-foot fishing pontoon that we rigged up. And so between those two boats, in the springtime, as soon as the ice comes off, both are rigged up with, you know, top-of-the-line electronics, Garmin side scan, and obviously live scope. And so we're just looking for fish. We're looking for those big schools of fish in the shallows. You know, you can figure when the water temp is this cold, and they're at least to the end of May, they're going to be in like less than 15 feet of water generally. So you're just cruising those shallows, and you're looking for fish. They stick out pretty good if you know what you're looking at, and you got your electronics set good. You can find them. When you find a couple, there's usually more, you know. It's kind of like finding morel mushrooms. You know, when you find two or three, there's usually about 100 of them that you can't see that are around you. And so the first thing I usually don't have any worms in my boat for the whole month of May. We're using all plastics and blade baits. We also catch them on jerk baits, so you can catch them on like a 5-inch mega bass jerk bait if you
Yeah.
catch them in like 7 feet of water, which is awesome too. It's another fun way to do it. But the primary thing that's going to be tied onto my rods when I'm guiding in the springtime are going to be blade baits, like a Deadly Tackle Company blade bait, like a quarter ounce blade bait, or you got your 1/8 ounce like Northland Minute Minnows work really good, like little tiny paddle tail plastics. And then also you have your Ned jigs or your Ned rigs. So if you have like an 1/8 ounce Ned jig tied on with like a little 3-inch, you know, Ned TRG rig, those are going to be like your primary three rigs that I like. They're super aggressive because usually when they're schooled up like that post spawn, they're going to be feeding. So they're super aggressive. So you don't really need to throw worms at them to, you know, and just kind of sit. You can usually cast at them and make them react. So you just, in the springtime, a lot of times we fish, we do 5-hour trips. So we do a morning trip and an evening trip. In the morning trip, when you get on the boat at 7 o'clock, you know, we've probably got about 4 to 5 spots in the back of our mind where we know there's a big school of perch, generally. And then that morning, those fish might move 200 yards, but they're going to be pretty easy to find with your electronics, and get back on them. So it's definitely a thing where, you know, if we're not in them, we're looking for them. And then usually when we find them, we're in them for, you know, a good hour or two. But yeah, it can be a fast and furious trip in the springtime for sure to get your 30 fish in the boat and then find other fish. A lot of times guys want to go try for smallmouth bass and perch and trout as well, which is totally cool because then we, you know, we can try something up or try to, you know, switch it up and try something new. But yeah, it's pretty fast and furious to put your 30 fish on the boat in the spring. As it transitions into like June, when the water starts warming up and the weeds start coming up, a lot of times they stop hitting, like when the water hits like 55 or 60, a lot of times they'll stop hitting blade baits. They'll slow down on the paddle tail jigs and the Ned rigs, and then you got to use worms. So we're casting drop shots with worms or just using worm rigs on the bottom to get those fish then as well. And they usually bite really good to like the end of June. After June, the weeds get too tall and then they also spread out. And it's just really hard to find, you know, schools of fish. So then we transition to other fisheries like trolling for trout, trolling for coho salmon that are in there, trolling for kokanee salmon. And then we do that till, you know, September till they start schooling up again.
I'm just sort of curious on the vibe of like, you know, probably being around them is the most important thing, right? You know, you're talking about how you cover ground to find them. But when you're around them, what are some other meaningful things like cadence you know, are the bigger fish, do they come up? Are you fishing on the bottom? I'm just sort of curious some of that.
Yeah, it's everything. You know, you obviously have to be in them to catch them. But the worst mistake that people make is they, especially in the springtime when they're shallow, is they'll get their boat too close to them. And those fish do spook really bad. So, you know, if you can use your side scan and then, you know, maybe mark a waypoint where you're 50, 60 feet away from the whole school or the edge of the school and cast into them, you can cast into that school repeatedly and they're not going to move, generally speaking. But when you have a guy, a lot of times they'll see it, you know, they'll see my boat out there and we're catching them. So they'll bomb up to where we're catching them. And then occasionally they'll throw an anchor overboard, you know, or do something like that to just kind of spook the whole school. And it just, when that happens, they just dissipate and they'll go, you know, they'll move about 200 yards, 300 yards, and then not come back, you know? So that just kind of throws a wrench in the works. So as long as you stay away from them and don't spook them, or if you're going to be on top of them, just like, don't kick on the trolling motor or don't fire up the big motor and, don't try not to spook them. And then as soon as you drift out of them, then stop and kick on the trolling motor with the spot lock and cast back to them. That's going to make you way more productive, in the long run. As far as like rigs and stuff like that goes, like we try to use, you know, artificials and plastics until we can't, you know, and then I get the worms out on the boat. And, you know, that just means that you have to clean your boat more when you have worms on there rather than casting like artificials and blade baits and stuff.
You know, talking about, you know, the patterns and stuff like that. I mean, is that sort of a big consideration on, you know, baits as far as colors matching the hatch? You know, curious about that springtime, maybe like the water condition, you know, clarity and you know, different conditions where that might make the bite, you know, struggle maybe, you know, just maybe talking about some of those topics of like, you know, but identifying, you know, what the main forages can be, if we can kind of sit on that topic for a little bit. I think that stuff's interesting.
Yeah. So one of the things with forage, what they're eating, I mean, year round, they eat baby perch minnows. So like young of the year perch minnows, even like 2-year-old perch minnows. so that they'll spawn in the springtime, create all these babies. And then usually by like middle of the wintertime, they got them pretty much eaten up. There's not a whole lot of them, but in like June and July, when those young of the year perch hatch, there's on Cascade, if you're driving in your traditional sonar or your downscan, there's, it doesn't matter where you're at, but if you're driving around the lake, you'll find clouds and clouds of baby perch minnows in the entire system. There's just, I mean, it looks like there's billions of them. There's just clouds and clouds of them. And as the season goes on and the summer goes on, obviously those perch minnows grow. And then in like the end of August and into September, when you're reeling in a perch, all those perch minnows come to the surface, obviously. So you see just the vast number of those perch minnows that they're just gorging on. So any like perch presentation or perch mimicking lure is going to be a lure that we're going to use, especially in the cold water when they're very reactive to moving baits, like blade baits, like I mentioned before. As far as colors go, Fire Tiger works good, but a lot of times the water clarity is really clear in the summertime or in the early springtime when the water's real cold. And so we're going to be using a lot of like just silver and pink, silver and blue, just something that's going to be shimmering but look a little bit more normal and natural. And then on top of the perch, what they're eating is snails. So there's in Cascade, there's a lot of tiny, really tiny snails, like the size of a tip of a eraser on a pencil, like that size snail. So they just gorge on those. So and when they're doing that, they're usually on weed lines and mud flats. But when they're gorging on snails, generally they're eating on worms. So the way I see it, or the way I kind of picture it in my mind, is that those perch are just slow moving. Obviously the snails aren't running away. So they can just eat them. You know, they're just eating them as they swim past. They see a snail on either the weeds or the mud, and they're just going to eat them. So a lot of times we're just using worms. When they're gorging on snails and you're cutting them open, they have a lot of snails in their bellies. Generally, they're going to bite worms, something more stationary than if they're biting, if like the whole school would be feeding on like, say, baby perch or something that's going to be fleeing. In the springtime, when they're, you know, right after ice out and they're schooled up, generally they're looking for those schools of baby perch minnows. And when they're eating perch minnows, like, they're very reactive to blade baits and pretty aggressive jigs. So like if I cast out a 1/4 ounce blade bait, it'll sink obviously in like 3 to 5 seconds if we're in like 5 to 10 feet of water. As soon as it hits bottom, I'm tightening up the line and I'm giving it like a 1 foot kind of a jerk or a snap back. And then I hold it on a tight line. It falls, and about 2 seconds later, you know, and you just work it in these 1 foot increments back to the boat, usually by about third hit or the third rip jig back. You can feel that vibration. You're going to hold it on a tight line and they're just going to smoke it. They're just going to hammer it. A lot like a walleye in the sense where you're fishing walleyes with blade baits. And that's kind of how I got the technique back in Wisconsin. I kind of brought that over here into Idaho, and not a lot of people were using blade baits before I kind of showed up and started using them and hammering them in the spring and in the fall. On that, it's probably my favorite way to catch them. Very user reactive, where you're going to be have all that feel in your rod, and you're feeling the vibration as you're pulling that blade bait back. And then when they hit it, you know, it's just a thump, and that's when obviously you set the hook and hammer them. But Ned rigs and stuff, they work pretty good too, as far as casting it out and just kind of dragging it on the bottom. Paddle tail jigs, usually, you know, you're trying to swim it about a foot off bottom or maybe hit bottom, bring it up a foot, slowly reeling it, you know, they love those too. But like I said, blade baiting when the water's colder than, say, 55, you know, they crush it. They love them.
What's your setup?
All of my rods are Shields rods, Shields Guide Series rods. You know, they're just a phenomenal graphite rod that's going to have a lot of backbone and a very soft tip. So like I use my ideal rod for blade baiting and Ned jig and paddle tail, casting little tiny paddle tail jigs would be like a 6'6" medium light, with either a fast or an extra fast tip. And then you're going to pair that with a Fluger President reel. And then I put a little bit of backing on there. Then I also put 8-pound Berkeley Fireline braid with that in the high vis green. I like the high vis green because when you're watching the line with the blade bait, obviously as soon as that blade bait hits, it sinks, like the line sinks. It's really easy to see. And then at the business end, I put about a 2 to 3 foot 10-pound Berkeley Vanish fluorocarbon leader, and then I tie that to, you know, obviously either a blade bait or a Ned jig or a little paddle tail jig. So that's like all my casting setups. With that 8-pound braid, super easy to cast, super easy to see. And then you have a lot of sensitivity. And then, like I said, the rod is pretty essential. I wouldn't want to go longer than, say, a 7-foot rod just because it'd be a little bit too spongy. Some people love 7-foot rods. And if that's what you're used to fishing, then obviously, you know, use with what you're used to. But the most important thing I would say would be the braid, being able to cast out there. And then you can also feel that bite, feel that initial tap on the end of your rod before you set the hook. And then obviously the rod itself, having it not be too heavy, like a medium rod would be too heavy. I have quite a few medium Shields guide series medium rods, and they're just a little bit heavy for that. If I was casting for like trout and stuff, that'd be great. But a lot of my casting rigs are all medium light. So another cool thing that I do that I found is, so all my casting rods are braid, and then a lot of my worm rigging rods, so like just a split shot hook and a worm, if you have those types of days where that's how you're catching them, all of those rods are all mono. So I have 6-pound just regular Berkeley Trilene mono rigged up with that. And for some reason, the mono just seems to tangle less, and you can, you know, you don't have to feel the bite. You don't have to feel that initial tap when you're using a split shot hook and a worm. You know, you cast it over the side of the boat or cast it away from the boat, and then it just sits on the bottom. And a lot of times those perch just swallow those worms, and then they just start running with it. And eventually you're going to feel, you know, the rod tips start to go, and then that's when the client just reels them in. So those worm rigs in like the month of June, a lot of times if I have a client that has never fished before, you know, they can just kill it after the day, because they're just casting it out, letting it sit. And those fish are going to be swallowing it and taking off of them. And obviously if the fish is hooked or swallows it and is hooked deep, which we're keeping those fish, obviously, you know, that person doesn't have to have the skill level to cast the blade bait. They can just sit there and hold the pole, and all of a sudden they got a fish on their line, you know?
You know, that's like medium walleye tackle, right? Like you're talking about setups that would work for walleyes, but we're talking perch fishing. But man, for anybody that hasn't put their hands on a lot of, you know, say 11 to 15 inch perch, like we're talking, it's not the same as reeling in an 11 to 15 inch walleye. These perch fight like a smallmouth bass.
Yeah, they dig. Oh yeah, it's phenomenal. In fact, I think we go fishing on the Columbia River every year for a week. We just got back about 2 weeks ago for walleye. So a lot of vertical jigging, and we're vertical jigging like 40 to 60 feet of water. A lot of times our rigs are pretty identical. You know, same pole, same line setup. You know, you're using 8-pound braid, 10-pound fluorocarbon, and you're catching those 15 to 20 inch walleyes on the same, you know, medium light rods that you'd be using for blade bait and Ned rigging on Cascade. So
yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, what else should we touch on for this spring bite? It's all fascinating to me, because it's kind of you know, it's just such a cool place. And not to let it get lost in the conversation, we're not just standard. We're talking about a standard perch fishing trip. We're talking about being up in the mountains and all those cool things that you alluded to before. I just don't want that to get lost in the conversation, that when you're doing this in such a beautiful place, such a cool, unique place. It's just a destination, a family destination, just like and for you and your wife, life-changing. You know, you visited there and it ultimately, you know, became a complete lifestyle shift, and you moved out there,
sure.
And it's like that could, you know, it's that kind of place that can move you that much, just your soul, and it's just I just don't want that to get lost in the conversation. But anything else that we got to touch on here before we close out?
Yeah, just getting back to what you said a second ago, I mean, Lake Cascade is so special in the setting and the location and how hard it is to get to. It's definitely a destination. Goes, and the fact that there's, you know, that amount of big perch in the lake is kind of just a bonus in the sense. But a lot of my clients, like when they're coming in the springtime, they're hitting up the hot springs, or they're going into the mountains that are all, you know, public land, and they're picking morel mushrooms, you know, by the bagfuls, or they're picking huckleberries or they're going to like up to McCall, which is a kind of a cool little town, and they're doing you know, those touristy things too. So there's so many other things to do in Cascade aside from like catching 15 inch perch that kind of get missed in the conversation. And that what that does is it makes it kind of a family trip. It turns it from a group of guys coming from the Midwest to catch fish into, you know, maybe a husband and wife and a couple kids come out for a family vacation, fishing me for 2 to 3 days, you know, go into the mountains, pick mushrooms, go to the hot springs, go out for dinner and go to the ski resort and explore that. And it's kind of cool. So that means we just get all kinds of kinds in the summer, in the spring and in the fall that we generally don't get ice fishing. Ice fishing, we usually take a lot of these diehard anglers from the Midwest, you know, a group of five guys or six guys coming out for 3 days and they just want to catch one over 15, you know? So the springtime, it's absolutely phenomenal. I always joke that if you want to come and catch fish on Cascade, come in the springtime. If you want to come and catch that one fish that's going to be, you know, your wall hanger that's got a huge belly, come in the wintertime. You know, but yeah. It's just Cascade. The cool thing about it is it's obviously well known for ice fishing. It's been well known for about 5 or 6 years, maybe even a little bit longer than that. It's definitely blown up, but the open water fishing is kind of this untapped thing, you know, and we're busy, don't get me wrong, but we're way more busy ice fishing. And I think the fishing, as far as numbers and it being warm is better in the spring and in the fall. So.
Anything else that we close out with? Otherwise, I would say, you know, just throwing out your contact information or anything that you want to promote.
Yeah. If people want to reach out to me, I mean, obviously you can hopefully add my phone number in the show comments or whatever. But yeah, if you reach out to Tamarack Resort, if you Google Tamarack Resort in Idaho and look at their fishing, it'll be all my information there, my phone number and my email as well. If you want to look me up on Instagram, it'd be lake_cascade_guided_fishing. We're usually posting, I post a lot of my story about what I'm doing daily. And then, you know, a couple times a week, I'll put a post up as far as what the clients are catching. And then we've made quite a few YouTube videos on Lake Cascade and some other lakes in the area, but mainly Lake Cascade in the springtime for like blade baiting. If you want to see how we do that, I have a YouTube channel as well. So if you just Google Lake Cascade, Chris Weber, you know, a lot of those videos will come up and it'll kind of give you an understanding of, you know, one, how many we're catching in the springtime and then how we're catching them as well. So.
All right. Well, I'll let you back to it and we'll stay in touch. Sounds good, Chris. Man. Thanks, man.
Appreciate everything. Bye.
Talk to you.